Now, there are some things that will change. Ah, what an understatement. Welcome back to Sparkwood in 21, the No Ship Network podcast on the Showtime television series Twin Peaks. This is a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
If you like what you hear, head on over to noship.net where you can find all of the other podcasts that we do. If you like horror, we have Penny Dreadful and Ash vs. Evil Dead. If you like historical, we have Vikings and Spartacus. And if you're anything like us, we also have Handmaid's Tale and American Gods. Contact us through Gmail and leave us a review on iTunes. Also check out the TV Time app. It lets you keep track of all your favorite shows as well as participate in a community of like-minded fans. Check it out. It's cool.
And because we are partners with TV Time is the reason why we're breaking this final 2 hours up into two podcasts, into part 17 and part 18, because it works better with our app if they have two separate podcasts that they can provide to their users. So we're going to cover part 17, and then you'll be able to, right after, be able to listen to part 18 at your leisure. Also, just a couple of announcements before we get into the recap. I want to let everybody know if you have found that you really like listening to our podcasts and you want to continue to follow No Ship Network, we have coming up in November our Vikings podcast, and then that will be followed by our Ash versus Evil Dead podcast. You can find more about that on our website at noship.net. It's pretty much the same style as how we cover Twin Peaks. It's a fan-made podcast for fans. In the meantime, before November, we're also going to be producing two commissioned podcasts. One of them will be discussing the film The Exorcist and also David Lynch's Dune. The Exorcist will be released in toward the end of this month, depending on hurricane weather. So I'm going to put that out there.
Yeah,
we do live in the state of Florida. In Dune, we plan to have out sometime in October. We have a feed that we feature our commission podcasts in, and that's the No Ship Network Transmissions and Commission Podcast feed. And that's a good feed to subscribe to if you want to get updates about our network.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, we also plan to cover additional shows such as The Exorcist series, Stranger Things, and Steve and I are going to finish covering what we've started with The Sopranos. And we do that for our members. They're subscribed members who pay a small monthly fee, and they get access to additional content that we create beyond what we put out on iTunes. We're going to announce the winner of the Double R mug on the part 18. So that will be at the end of the recap on part 18.
Yeah, perfect.
There'll be something positive at the end of 18 that we can give to people.
Make someone feel a little bit better.
Yeah. That's right.
All right, so now we're going to go ahead and get into a recap, and we're discussing The Return, Part 17, The Past Dictates the Future. Any thoughts?
I'm not going to lie, I was disappointed. There was things that I liked, but there was moments where I didn't know what the fuck was going on. No idea. I literally was sitting on the couch going, and that's pretty average, but I had no fucking idea what was going on. And then there was parts where I was just like, oh, really? Because it seemed a bit anticlimactic for the scene at the sheriff's station, you know? It bothered me. And then it kind of set me off into a weird direction. I watched him a second time, and things kind of worked out better, and then I dove into the internet just to try and have somebody maybe lift me up a little bit. So it was just a whole ball of emotions for it.
I think I like part 18 more, but I can't say I enjoyed it because it was actually quite traumatic for me, especially when it fade to black. So I don't really want to go into that while we're discussing part 17. So we'll talk about that when we get to that.
I feel like we got they did something pretty clever here. They gave us two endings. They gave us an ending in part 17 that all of the fans wanted. It could have been a lot more. It could have went in different directions, but I think it was satisfactory for those people who wanted something more along the lines of a linear type ending. And I liked 17 a lot. 18, I'm not saying I didn't like it. It did leave me somewhat intentionally so on pins and needles at the end going, wait a minute, did this show just end right now? You know, and I feel as though there's a lot to episode 18, but I feel like it was less Twin Peaks and more David Lynch giving you a character from Twin Peaks traveling in a different world, in a different backdrop. Mm-hmm. With different characters.
Yeah.
And it kind of, some of the concepts of it dovetailed, and the overarching thing was ostensibly Twin Peaks, but it felt very different than Twin Peaks. That's why you're only in Twin Peaks for a very, very small amount of time, and it's super late at night. And, well, you know, we'll get into it more then, but I feel like you got two very distinct episodes for two different mindsets as far as how this series should have ended, how this finale should have ended. One felt like it was for the fans, and one felt like it was for the art of it all.
Yeah.
My
main problem is that I tried this. I watched episode one and then put on episode 18 right after, and it works without 2 through 17. And that's a big problem I've got, though, because just give us 1 and 18. You know, it's like, I don't know. Like I say, like Em said, when we get through it, there'll be plenty to talk about for sure. So.
Yeah, I think there's more to it than the emotional damage it caused. So like that, with me trying to figure things out has actually been a sort of like triage I've applied, or it's been like, it's repaired some of the emotional.
No, because it makes sense, because like I said, I went online and found a blog, and I went through different places, and I've been real good about not going online, even opening Twitter before we pod, because like Steve and you guys, I want it to be my idea and fresh, but it hurt me so bad that I needed to find something to make it to where it's like, okay, I can talk about this. And the one that I found, I actually retweeted on Twitter, because he kind of made it to where it's like, it's a really smart idea, and I'll mention it and make sure I quote it on the few things that I'm going to talk about when I feel like I need to bring certain things up, because it did. It helped me. And I know, and I'm hoping that our listener feedback will, and you guys, every time I think I don't, you know, I have issues with something, you guys kind of lift me up. So hopefully we can do this for other people too. So I'm ready. Let's do it.
Okay. So now into recap, and we open back in South Dakota in the hotel room where Gordon, Albert, and Tammy are seated, and Gordon is holding his gun saying that he just couldn't do it. Albert says, "You're getting soft in your old age." And Gordon Cole says, "Not where it counts, buddy." Which is one of the few laugh out loud moments I had among these two, this being one of them. But I also think this is commentary. This is a warning that David Lynch is not getting soft in his old age either.
No.
And he pulled that rug hard on us.
Yes. Spit on us.
So they're drinking wine and they toast to the Bureau, which Steve and I had alcohol beverages, and we toasted it too. We're like, oh yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, we had a whiskey toast to the FBI.
Awesome.
So Gordon confesses that he has kept things from Albert for 25 years. And he informs both Gordon and Tammy that Major Briggs shared with Cooper and Gordon a discovery of an extreme negative force called Joude, which is now known as Judy. Major Briggs, Cooper, and Gordon put together a plan that would lead them to Judy. Then something happened to Major Briggs, and then something happened to Cooper. Philip Jeffries, who no longer exists, at least in the normal sense, told Gordon a long time ago that he was on to this entity, and then he disappeared. Last thing Cooper told Gordon, "If I disappear like the others, come and try to find me. I am trying to kill two birds with one stone." And at first I was like, wait, which Cooper said that to him? Because it's not like we were ever privy to that conversation.
Right. We don't know when it happened. Mm-hmm. So if it happened sometime after the original Twin Peaks incident, it could have very well been. But
he even wonders about that, I think, because I think that's why he says, now this thing of two Coopers.
Yeah.
We also learn here that Ray was a paid informant, and he told the FBI that Mr. C was looking for coordinates from Major Briggs. Gordon says that we should have heard from Agent Cooper, and right then, phone rings, and it's Agent Headley from the Las Vegas FBI office, and they have found Dougie, but then again, they haven't. He's not there. But thankfully, Bushnell Mullins is there to dictate the message that Cooper had left, which was to inform Gordon that he was heading to the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Department.
I like how Bushnell says, "I'm his boss." Like, he's all proud of it. You know, he's like, "I'm his boss."
And Gordon says, "That makes two of us."
That makes two of us. And this is the first time I've been aware of themes of duality in Twin Peaks, the end.
You just got lynched.
Yep.
So Tammy gets Gordon up to speed regarding Dougie's recent activity, including sticking a fork into an electrical socket and ended up in a coma.
Which apparently, according to Albert, that's even a little bit out there for Cooper.
Yeah.
I feel like this this whole statement of two birds with one stone is it's about overreach. He's trying to do too much, and that's why he's not being successful.
I agree with that.
And this is like the first kind of, not the first inkling of it, because you heard the fireman say it earlier in The Return, but I feel like it's the first we're getting going towards the end.
So after all this is reported to Gordon about Dougie's recent activities, he says, "I blew case, most definitely." And then he says, "Pack it up. I know where he's going." So now at the Twin Peaks Sheriff Department, Chad waits for, I'm just calling him Billy. It's never been confirmed who this guy is.
They leave it up to us. He's Billy.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's what you get.
So Chad waits for Billy to be sound asleep, and it's not easy. It takes a little while. There's some "you fucker" and "fuck yous" traded back and forth.
Yeah. Mud mouth.
Yeah. We see power lines in a darkened sky. Mr. C is driving the night road. Nato seems to sense his coming. Mm-hmm. And she starts to chitter in her sleep. James asks Freddie, "What the hell is that?" gesturing towards Nato. The chittering intensifies with Billy starting to chime in, as he's done before.
It was cool that she could sense him, and the buildup was pretty awesome. It was like the first, like at the beginning, it's like, oh shit, it's about to go down. We're going to see it. And the buildup was really nice. It really was. It was fantastic.
I just don't know where, you know, why Nato, I guess it seems like Nato was only there really to serve as a way to hide the true identity of that person.
Right. That's one of the disappointing things that happen in the next like 20 minutes that you're like, oh, really? I expected more from her also. That's why I wanted to say how much I enjoyed the buildup. You know, that first 20, 30 minutes, it was like, oh, this is going to be so good. You know, I mean, I was amped. So that's why. I mean, but then it's like, that's all she was a peanut shell over Diane. You know, it was like, okay, cool. Like, at least we got the peanut, you know.
You do expect more from that character, because you think that there's going to be this drawing together of all these forces that will be arrayed against Mr. C, the mother, Bob, and all the negativity, and Judy, as we come to know it. But then you see that one of them is really just, like you said, a peanut with a peanut shell with a Diane.
Yeah,
peanut.
I mean, exactly.
She's an M&M. She's an M&M.
I'll go with M&M. I'll go with that.
So now we've got a quick scene with Benjamin Horn, and he's receiving a phone call about a naked Jerry in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, where Jerry's been taken into custody because he was found naked, as I've already mentioned, and he also believed that he killed someone with his binoculars. But he would have to cross the state of Idaho diagonally to get to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, from the top of pretty much like where Spokane is over, and then diagonally down, which is a long ways down Idaho, to get to Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
It takes you 8 hours of highway drive time to get from Portland to Boise, Idaho.
Yeah.
Roughly 8 hours, because we made the trip a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And so you've got to figure from Boise to Jackson, if you're going to keep going, is another however many hours. Mm-hmm. He had to hit a vortex at some point.
For sure.
There's no way. Yeah,
he Super Mario'd that shit and hit one of those portals. Because obviously he was kind of in tune with those things, because he runs up on his nephew getting shocked to death. So maybe he was just kind of running towards each one and like a connect the dot type thing, and then got sucked up into one and kicked out, because that would explain where his clothes went. Maybe he just said, maybe the woodsmen were like, okay, you can come through, but take all your clothes off. Ours are filthy. Yeah. We'll take yours. Yeah. Like there's a woodsman with all of his clothes on.
He paid for passage.
Yeah, that's the toll.
What you got?
That's the toll you got to pay.
You can keep the binos. Those are gross.
Yeah. Who knows what you've been doing with those? Even to us, they're gross.
I felt bad for him. It was like, man, that poor guy, you know. No one's ever going to believe him. He's running around naked, and he's batshit crazy now. Whatever happened to Jerry Horn in the woods must have been terrible.
Oh, man. And we were totally wrong, or at least I was, because I had hypothesized that maybe at the, you know, like right at the end, he kind of blunders into a scene of climax and knocks over the bad guy or something, does something that helps out the good guys. But nope, he just ended up running around naked talking about his binoculars. So.
Well, do you think that this happened to Jerry within this storyline because he wasn't redemptive, unlike Ben? Because we saw Ben actually change his ways as far as how he seemed to navigate his relationship with Beverly, and where Jerry was still maintaining the same kind of attitude that they had a long time ago.
That's a good point to bring up. Yeah, he didn't have a pathway to redemption. So maybe that's what they had to do with him. But keeping that in mind, there's so many characters that didn't get revisited at all. They didn't have to even bring him in.
But he was a bit of the comic relief, too, though. So they just kept him then. Yeah. You know, when you need something light, you know, to kind of mix things up, have him come running out of the woods and fall and run back some more, you know, or talk about his foot. Or, I mean, we got a lot out of him. So at least he served purpose for commentary.
Now we see the power lines again. Mr. C is now at Jackrabbit's palace. The coordinates that he needed all along, or at least thought he needed, these are the ones that Major Briggs gave him when this was a trap, actually.
Mm-hmm.
He goes up into the vortex. Mr. C is now in the fireman's lair or realm, whatever you want to call it.
Pad.
It looks almost like a factory because you see all those other teapots in the background at one point. It's like, ooh, he's going to put him in a teapot. Get what you deserve.
And I wonder if that's like the end result once you're done evolving. If you're like Philip Jeffries, if you become one of many and your primary goal is to provide this life force for that particular
or part of the lodge,
part of the universe.
Or he's a collector and just collects certain people.
But he's steam powered, so maybe he is outside of that. Maybe he won't evolve along that way. But steam power came before electricity, so maybe that is part of the evolution.
Yeah, you keep going, and electricity is the highest form. Mm-hmm. That's where all the real work gets done.
We see that Major Briggs' head is now here with the fireman.
Right.
So is he going to be a permanent residence here, or is he just here because he knew that this event was going to happen, because it's even made mention?
Well, it's just Cooper his head, so maybe the fireman cut his head off and sent the body back so he can preserve Major Briggs, because at least he's got company.
Why not just like keep his body intact?
Don't ask the fireman why he does what he does.
It's not a space issue because now his head's huge.
Huge.
So I think it's this was a place that Briggs could go and be safe from all of these people who are chasing him down. Because even though Mr. C's not actively doing it anymore, he's gone on to other things. You got the impression from Bill Hastings that he needed to seek asylum somewhere and he was hiding out. So this would be the perfect place to go because the fireman's just going to let you chill. And they probably have like real nice, slow, cordial conversations with each other.
Maybe Major Briggs was just partially in through a socket. He only got his head through before
somebody
his body was lopped
in.
Off.
I don't know.
So his head happened to be on the side of the supernatural area.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It was awesome thinking that he got trapped, though. That was totally unexpected. I was like, oh, awesome. He's trapped. And then they're moving him towards the machine. I was like, what are they going to do with him? I was like, shoot him back into the lodge. Pew!
I think they had to cage him because he's a volatile
for
element,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So, but they have laws they have to uphold. It's not like they can, and maybe, I mean, because they knew they were sending him to where they wanted him to go. Mm. And maybe that's just the beginning of the trap, is like getting him in there. So they've got him in the cage. But it is funny when they start moving the cage towards the screen. I swear to God, he looks like one of those troll dolls. Like his hair is electrified. And standing on end, unless I saw it wrong.
I don't know.
You didn't see it wrong.
So you already mentioned the room that's filled with bells. Mm-hmm. And I think they're just like super cells. They're like super batteries that are there to supply the ability to transport.
It could be a warning sign for different worlds, too. Like he's got a room full of them, of all these different realities, worlds, just all of them.
Keeping tabs on everything.
Mm-hmm. Like if one of them goes off, he's got to go deal with that one. That's why he's the fireman, right?
Putting out the fires.
Doing something. Shooting bad guys through a gold cannon is what he's doing.
Yeah.
And so Mr. C is transported in the same way that Laura's orb was transported. And now he's in front of the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Department. And he's just like, what's this? So he wasn't expecting to land there. And Nato is startled awake because she senses him nearby. Andy's in the parking lot and he sees Mr. C and he says, Agent Cooper, is that you? And he sounds a lot like when you could hear Andy's voice coming over the phone when Agent Cooper was shot.
He sounds exactly like that when he says, Agent Cooper. And he sounds just that same tone, the same pitch, everything.
He says, we were just talking about you. So now we cut back down to the jail cells, and Billy finally passes out. And Chad is finally able to remove his boot, and he uncovers his hidden compartment in the heel, which we've seen this before.
We've seen this before?
With Leo.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, that's right.
New shoes. It wasn't keys, though. It was coke.
But. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, but not. He's got a skeleton key that he's able to use for many different things. We'll see. So now Annie's bringing Mr. C before Lucy and Sheriff Truman.
They should have known right away that this was not the right Mr. C because he turned down the coffee.
Right.
Yeah, that's one certain.
Dead giveaway.
Yeah. Once...
Besides the black eyes, the long hair, the bad guy clothes, yes. And the general demeanor. The refusal
stare.
Of coffee. The blank stare. Yeah. The shark look.
He's actually pretty practiced and smiling, though. I was like, wow, good job, Mr. C. You're almost pulling it off.
And, you know, he had the politeness and cordiality right down because he was like, hello, Andy. You know, it's just.
And he's the one who moved to shake hands first mm-hmm. with Sheriff Truman.
Disarm your opponent.
Hmm. So yeah, the offer of coffee doesn't happen until Mr. C is actually in Sheriff Truman's office sitting before him. But before we get to that, we see Andy recalls what the fireman showed him regarding Lucy, placing Lucy in front of a room at the department.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now we're back with Chad, and he unlocks his way out of his cell, and he makes his way into the locker room, and he's using that same key to unlock a locker. And now Mr. C takes a seat before the sheriff, declines a cup of coffee. Nato becomes more aggravated. Andy leaves Truman's office to find Hawk. Billy removes his bandage, and he starts to finger his wound, and he's getting increasingly agitated, and it's really off-putting. Like, I got chills watching him do that.
Oh, yeah.
No good. I had to stop. I was eating something at the time, and I was like, oh, I'm going to... No, we had blueberry pie, and let's just put that down for a second. And
Andy comes running in, yelling for Hawk among the cells because he's unable to find him. Chad confronts Andy right there. Freddie, who's in cell number 8, knocks Chad out by punching his cell door and forcing it to swing violently into Chad's face, right when Chad was about to shoot Andy between the eyes.
This is when you really start to feel it heat up. You know you're watching a good episode. You know some stuff that you want to see happen is going to happen.
For
you don't
sure.
know how far they're going to take it and how much good stuff you're going to get. But I, for one, was hoping Chad was dead.
Absolutely. I'm hoping he's dead, too. I mean, hit in the face yeah. with a steel bar, iron bars. It's good.
Yeah. After Freddy does it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a chance.
Yeah, most likely.
Blunt force trauma like that.
Yeah, so that's Chad's storyline dealt with. And also Billy's, because we don't see Billy again after this. He doesn't come up with the other cellmates up into the room.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. He just rots in that cell.
I don't know if he rots or if he just doesn't exist once Chad's out of the picture.
Yeah.
Hmm.
It's possible. I just don't think anybody let him out. You know, like, why would Chad not? Why would Chad being, well, that could be linked.
Why would Andy decide that it's safe for certain people, but we don't need to worry about this guy?
Well, his face is peeling off and he's spitting up oil and goop and shit. I wouldn't unlock him either, ever. I'd leave him in there or call a hospital, probably. That would be more like it. We need
a
hospital.
Yeah, he should be quarantined and away from other cellmates if you think there's something going on, but they're not thinking like that, clearly.
Can you imagine if it was you and you got the key? It's like, okay, I'll let you out. You're already out. Lady with no eyes, we need you. And, oh, okay, let's go, guys, and just leave. Yeah. You stay there. Gross.
Yeah, turn the lights off in the corridor as you go. Click. Night.
Night.
Imagine if he. I like the idea of him disappearing because I don't remember James or Freddie interacting with him.
Mm-mm.
Yeah,
I don't. That doesn't mean it didn't happen, but I don't quite recall it off the top of my head. But let's say that he didn't disappear and Chad didn't die, and he wakes up and he's staring him straight in the face. You know, this he's all like
sitting
real close
him.
To him. Yeah. Shut up, Chad.
Just leaking that shit in his face. He would deserve it. He would deserve it.
Phone rings at the front desk. Lucy says, who? Lucy transfers the call to Sheriff Truman. It's Agent Cooper. Thank goodness. Truman and Mr. C go for their guns. Lucy shoots Mr. C. What made Truman's hat jump? Because I didn't see a bullet hole in it.
You know, I'm reminded of one of the final scenes in the series Justified, where Raylan and the bad guy, I can't remember his name, but they have like a face-off, and the other guy's supposed to be a badass marksman, and they shoot each other, but the bullet that hits Raylan Givens just goes through his hat, just barely grazes his head. I thought maybe something like that happened, but just
went
as Em
through.
Said, there's no bullet hole. So I don't know if this is some homage to like some slapstick kind of thing from other movies, or maybe the bullet whizzed past his head, like went underneath the brim just enough to lift it up.
Oh, yeah. Wow. That
like
might
a through and through, but just kind through. Of, yeah. Well, like we don't know. It could have grazed the hat in any place and you wouldn't yeah. see it. You know what I mean? Like he could have put it on. It could have gone like through Mr. C and just kind of like clipped the side of it or clipped the very tip of it. You know, it doesn't have to hit it direct, but I don't know if that, I don't know if her gun would do that. I mean, I'd like to think it's a little slapsticky. You know, I'm okay with it.
It's funny because like the first time you watch it, you're just so caught up in the action and they mm-hmm. only focus on him for a second, then they move on. So you go on to the next thing. The second time, second viewing, you're like, what? There's nothing wrong with his hat. What mm-hmm. happened? So I'm going with it just went up right up underneath it and it either gave enough air push on its way by or it touched, you know, grazed yeah. the underside of it and popped it up
now,
a little bit.
This is where some warning signs started coming up for me. Like a little red flag came up like, okay, Mr. C gets shot. It's, you know, this guy's a total badass. Lucy does it. I was cool with that. Like, okay, yeah. I like it. I was kind of hoping for like the Undertaker sit up, like bong, and he just sits up. Like that shit didn't affect me, y'all. And it starts fucking people up. Didn't happen, but we'll go on with the recap because I don't want to jump too far ahead.
Okay.
But that, you know, it was a little bit of a red flag. It's like, okay, we're going to see something else happen. You know, Bob comes out in his own form or something. I don't know. I was ready.
So Sheriff informs Cooper that the other one's dead, and Cooper tells him to not touch the body. Andy has brought the cellmates now into the room. Lucy says that she understands cellular phones now.
The great victory of this episode yeah. is now that Lucy gets it. She understands. This is a breakthrough for her.
Hawk runs into the room. Truman tells Hawk it isn't Agent Cooper. And Hawk says, but it is Agent Cooper. No, it's not.
Who gave Lucy the gun, first of all? I'm just saying.
I don't know, but Andy runs off inexplicably at this point. I'm not sure where he's heading to.
He went to go get Bobby, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think Bobby arrived on his own because he's just all like, what's going on? Like, nobody told him anything.
Maybe he had some anxiety and he thought he should run it out a little bit. I got to pee.
We still don't know why he had a Rolex and Bora Bora tickets and stuff. But anyway, the room darkens. Woodsmen approach and do their thing. Cooper now enters and a hot and steamy Bob orb emerges from Mr. C's body.
It's a great way to put it.
Hot and steamy. Mm-hmm. Bob.
Yep.
The Bob orb first strikes at Cooper. And Freddy shouts, oi! Cooper says, are you Freddy? And Freddy says, that's right. And this is my destiny. And it's interesting that Cooper knew that there'd be a Freddy involved. We haven't seen any type of indication that he would know anything like that.
Yeah.
So I think this is why Dougie was so focused on Bushnell's poster. Because he knew there was going to be some sort of boxing match. And this is it right here.
Ah, good callback.
And we don't know how many times Coop has actually done this. It could be like an eternal loop.
Oh, man.
Maybe.
Well, if that's the case, at least there's hope for him getting it right at some point.
We hope.
You know. Fingers crossed. Yeah. Well, not that we're going to get to see it, nope. But, it, you
25
know.
25 years. They'll find a hidden manuscript by David Lynch.
So eventually Bob is punched into the floor and he becomes a pillar of fire. And then he reemerges partially molten and attacks Freddy again. So this I thought was like playing on some like tropes, like mm-hmm. like where you fight a villain, you think he's vanquished, and well, no, he's not. But it was interesting to me that when he's a pillar of fire, it's like you're seeing him in his purest form because it's Bob, fire walk mm-hmm. with me, and he's a result of the atom bomb, like we're assuming right. that whole thing. So he's like Bob uncontained at that point. The final blow that actually works is when he's able to fragment him. So he's still contained but disorganized. Mm-hmm. It didn't seem like a permanent thing. Like it seems like those things could actually like come yes. back together at some point, but it might take a long time.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that because it did. It kind of like flew off in different pieces, but you never got the definitive destroyed.
Yeah.
Because it would have felt more definitive mm-hmm. if they had shattered and then fallen to the floor and just kind of smoked or something, you know, or even if they went into the floor and you yeah. were just like, okay, well, they're dying out. But when they go up like that, you think it's going to rise, then converge again into back into a mm-hmm. ball. But he's going to go like rest and recuperate kind of thing.
Yeah.
So now Cooper puts the owl cave ring on Mr. C. Mr. C vanishes. Rodney says, one for the grandkids. And we see the owl cave bounce into the lodge. Cooper asks Truman for the key. So he's known that Truman was going to have a key because this has been all set up by Major Briggs. Or Major Briggs has informed Cooper of certain events. Cooper now approaches Nato because she has caught his attention. And at this point, Cooper's face looms large and is superimposed over the scene for a while. At the moment I saw that, I said, oh, Cooper's a dreamer. I don't think he's the only dreamer, maybe the primary dreamer, mm-hmm. if there is a primary dreamer.
Well, this is where I'm going to bring up that blog a little bit because it helps me. It's kind of breaking the fourth wall to where it's staring at us during this scene. So we kind of would be the dreamer in that aspect. Because even earlier when Gordon Cole is looking over his shoulder and looking at the old one, he looks directly into the camera during his dream. I'm going to put a pin in that. I'm going to come back to it in part eight or even later on this episode. I don't want to kind of put it all, but this really helped me with these two episodes because it's like, okay, because there's more to it. And like I said, the guy that wrote this is fantastic because it really does kind of make sense the way he describes everything and it calmed me. But it's OZBAWordPress.com and the guy's name is Theon, Theone, Threes blog. That's all it says about it.
Okay.
About who wrote it. And it's this long, wonderful article. Like I said, I've got it on my Twitter feed at Molten Forge and it's fantastic. Theon 3 blog at WordPress.com.
Okay. So you have anything more that you want to say about that?
No, just kind of put a pin in that. So when the face comes in, he's kind of looking at us. And it's like throughout the whole scene, because this is the part where I was sitting there going, what the hell is going on? You know, and at first I was like, my own personal reaction, because I don't want to take credit for what I just said, because I did not come up with that, was, okay, this is Mr. C in him, because we don't see him in... At that point in the lodge, I was like, okay, this is kind of them coming together, you know, like merging back together. Now, granted, that gets blown out of the water in a few scenes coming up, but that's how I felt, not what Theon did.
I do agree that we're part of the dreamer dynamic that's happening. I didn't really think about it in relation to that because I took it as more as he was observing everything that was going on, not really looking directly at us. But he had this really almost impassive way because you see Cooper actually respond to Nato turning into Diane with joy.
Yeah.
Where the looming face doesn't respond in any type of emotional way to that. But at this point, though, before we get to that, Bobby strolls in and he says, what's going on around here? And that's when Bradley says, took the fucking words right out of my mouth. That was the second LOL moment for me.
You know, we did miss a big opportunity to have these guys and Candy, Mandy, and Sandy eating cherry pie and drinking coffee at the Double R and interacting with all of the locals. But this is probably the second best thing, to have them at the sheriff's station and interacting with some of the, you know, original cast.
Yeah.
Which it was really nice.
It's like people in Vegas like sandwiches, so they're just bringing their sandwiches
everywhere,
with them.
Right. I don't want to be negative, but I was disappointed because this is when it sinks into you that this is the end of Mr. C. This is probably the end of Bob and all that, you know, and then that everybody's just kind of standing there like, you know, watching this take pass. It's like, now granted, I'm a puss, so I would be freaking out at this point, but this is where it's like, it really starts to sink into me like, okay, this is the direction. But at the same time, it's like, there's a lot of time left. So I was still trying to hold on to the hope that, okay, get ready, because now you really have no idea what's coming.
Well, see, I wasn't thinking like that, and I explained this to Steve actually last night. I didn't think like that because we just had the opening of the episode with Gordon talking about the extreme negative entity.
Yeah.
So to me, that was like, this is going to be the ultimate bad. This is, you know, Mr. C and Bob are just
small fries.
Yeah, or small fries, just its minions essentially. Okay. So I wasn't going, oh, what? But I was like, oh my God, we still have lots of time left. Right. I mean, we're going to have a whole bunch of really cool things happen.
Yeah. Now we got Judy to deal with.
One thing on Major Briggs before we move on is all of this stuff is popping up in this episode that we have not seen before. We were not privy to the conversations between Dougie/Cooper and Major Briggs, obviously. Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of stuff apparently that was talked about. Like, you know, when he tells Bobby that your dad knew about all of this and he predicted it and everything like that. So it makes a whole lot of sense that you have Major Briggs' face in the fireman's lair because he's there to watch all this stuff happening. I think it's under his direction. They says, okay, when he gets here, you stick him in that machine and you shoot him back out to the Twin Peaks Sheriff Station.
Yeah.
That's where I want him to go. And I think he was working in conjunction with the fireman to get all this done. It was like under his direction.
Yeah, it makes sense because they have all the screens too of everything that could happen. So he just keeps it all organized.
Yeah, like a slideshow.
Mm-hmm, exactly. That's a good point.
So, I mean, the fact that Major Briggs is able to achieve some sort of success working in the afterlife or underworld or wherever he is, mm-hmm. Did he have like a better grasp of what he was dealing with than Cooper did overall? Because like he's actually making some progress compared to poor Cooper.
Mm-hmm. I feel like that could be the case because, you know, at this point, we know who is part of the Blue Rose community and who has always been part of it.
Yeah.
Back in the original series and Fire Walk With Me, you didn't really get the impression that Cooper was in on this inner circle or Albert. You know what I mean? I didn't anyway.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like they were there as much as they are now into
Cooper's
all of this.
Cooper's the one who comes and investigates Desmond's disappearance.
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it would have to do with Blue Rose. It's an FBI agent that disappeared.
It's an FBI agent that was investigating a Blue Rose case, and then when he disappeared, Cooper was sent to go investigate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but I'm just saying that I never got the impression that he knew as much about all of this stuff as you would need to know to do all of this other stuff. So to answer your question, I think that Briggs had a better handle on the ins and outs and the ups and downs of all of this kind of stuff.
Well, especially since he's the one that's dispensing the knowledge to the FBI, so.
Right. And, you know, I go back to the conversation when you have, when Cooper is telling, and it's when they first get to, or right around the time they start talking about Wyndham Earl in the original series, and he talks about the small man in his dream, and he says, any relation to the giant? They're having this very, almost like snarky, at least on Albert's side, back and forth. If they were both in on the whole Blue Rose stuff, it seems like they would have been talking a little bit more in code and saying some things that...
I think Gordon, as we saw with this episode and as we've known throughout watching The Return, did a need-to-know basis as far as like how he informed his agents. Yeah. And I also think the more that Albert learned over these past 25 years is the reason why we don't have the old Albert anymore. That's why he lost all his snark.
Yeah.
I mean, this kind of knowledge will fuck you up.
That's
and
true.
You're not gonna have that sort of spirit anymore. I mean, mm-hmm. You're going to probably feel weighed down by that truth.
Okay. I can go with that.
Yeah, I like
that
it.
That makes sense.
So I think maybe early on, what you're talking about, that particular conversation, he was still being initiated in some ways. He hadn't been exposed to everything, but he knew enough to where they brought him in on those special cases to perform their autopsies, to be their forensics guy.
Because he was the best.
He was the best and trustworthy.
Yeah.
So Cooper addresses Bobby and tells him that his father was well aware of what is going on here today. Bobby asks, what is going on? Cooper begins to explain Major Briggs had introduced Gordon Cole to this particular information, who is here right on time. So he doesn't actually really explain anything to Bobby or anyone.
No.
And so now Gordon Cole, Tammy, and Albert are there. So now everybody's assembled at the doorway. It's like they're dwellers on a threshold. Like, they don't come into the room. It's kind of a weird...
Yeah, they're clustered around. Yeah. And I don't know if it's because they just witnessed... Some of them, at least, just witnessed what happened with Mr. C, but...
It's maybe symbolic in a way, too. It's like how they're on this other side of a divide with Cooper. They're just not going there with him, maybe. But he says to them, now there are some things that will change. The past dictates the future. Any thoughts on why he said that?
I think it's to let us know, as the audience, that things are going to go sideways from here as far as what you've seen. You've seen a fairly linear episode up until this point of cause and effect. You've seen climaxes of storylines. You've seen a little bit of resolution. And you've been given some stuff that you want to see. Now we're going to, you know, like they used to say, and now for something completely different. And so as far as the past dictates the future, that feels like I'm being told that, hey, remember when we ended the original series and everybody got left on a wicked cliffhanger that never got resolved really until 25 years later? We're about to do that again.
Is this him putting out what his plan is, because he's saying now there are some things that will change the past dictates the future. So now there are some things that will change because I'm going to go change the past. So therefore, I'm going to change the future.
Oh, that could be it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you always have those kinds of laws when you're dealing with stuff like that. Or supposedly, you know, we don't really know how it works. But if you change something in the past, something in the future has to change. And we actually see that happen. He changed something in the future of the past, and then it gets pretty in the weeds.
Right.
At this point, Cooper tells Frank to give his regards to Harry. So I should have known better. I was just believing against facts that were out there on the internet, because Michael Ontkean said he's retired from acting, but I wanted to believe anyway that we would see Sheriff Harry S. Truman. So it's my own fault.
Well, we all wanted it to happen. You're not the only one.
Nato starts to speak up. And she approaches Coop. Her head transforms. This is, I guess, the peanut shell you're describing cracks off. and within her is the lodge. And her floating head now appears within the lodge itself. And Diane's face is revealed partially in shadow with inside the shell, or that fleshy looking shell. So Diane has replaced Nato within the sheriff department as well, and Cooper smiles happily, though his looming face, like I mentioned before, seems unmoved and detached. It's interesting because we saw that the lodge was inside her face, and then now with her new form in the terrestrial realm, her hair is the color of the red drapes and her nails are painted black and white.
Oh, okay.
So she almost becomes a physical embodiment of the lodge.
Yes.
Color-wise.
What does that mean? What does that say about the lodge?
Hmm.
I mean, because sometimes it feels like she's just not a real person, because, I mean, it was even speculated for the longest time before we ever got to the return whether she was real or not. Because she, like, he would tell her he needed earplugs and they would manifest, like, ridiculously quick, you know, for mail service at the time. So there was a debate whether or not she was a real person or if he was just speaking to something inside himself. So I do wonder if the show set out to make us think that they confirmed that she was real, but then in a way took that idea away from us again by still making it debatable, by having her be possibly just a symbolic representation of something within Cooper.
I think she exists. I just don't think that she exists in the normal, everyday human being fashion that we do. Because, with the lodge, with her head being a viewport into the lodge, doesn't really go any distance to explain how she could have been Nato at the same time. But it gives you that, like, okay, well, she's part of that dynamic more than just being a tulpa at some point.
Yeah, like she's trapped in the lodge, but she's using its powers to kind of send a form of herself out. You know what I mean? Like a robot almost. Or she was in there and whatever happened to her, like I said before, maybe she absorbed this somehow and that's what's... Or it's... I mean, there's like... so many different avenues that this could go. You know, it's crazy.
I do have to acknowledge at this point that there was a deleted scene from Fire Walk With Me where you do see Cooper talking to Diane, but you don't see her. He's just talking to her in the doorway of her office.
Hmm. I do remember when the existence of Diane being debated like this was one of the more conspiratorial and crazy ideas that were being thrown around about what's going on in Twin Peaks. Weren't those just the innocent days of it all?
So Cooper and Diane embrace romantically. Everyone watches. Cooper asks Diane if she remembers everything. She says yes. The clock seems stuck on 2:53. Cooper turns to their group at the doorway, the dwellers on the threshold, and this is when his superimposed face says, "We live inside a dream," which is very much like Mr. C's voice when he was an inmate at the South Dakota Penitentiary when Gordon and Tammy and Albert visited him. Cooper himself says, "I hope I see all of you again, every one of you." The room begins to darken. And then there's a whooshing sound, and Cooper yells panicky, "Gordon!" And Gordon yells, "Coop!" And those yells, especially Cooper yelling Gordon, is just like when Cooper yelled for Gordon when Philip Jeffries showed up in Fire Walk With Me at the FBI headquarters in Philadelphia. And so that actually got me thinking about, what if this is like through the looking glass of Philip Jeffries' journey in the underworld or afterlife or whatever you want to call this space, but we're seeing it as Cooper. So like Cooper only manifested briefly for all these people and then he vanished out just like Jeffries did in Fire Walk With Me.
I like that because he goes through a door and he comes back. He never comes back to this group of people, as far as we know.
Yeah.
So he doesn't disappear like Jeffries does in an instant. He doesn't get sucked because you get the impression that Jeffries disappeared against his will.
Yeah.
Like he was sucked back somewhere else, like into a vortex or something. And with Cooper, though, it's more of a deliberate thing. But if you're an observer, there's probably not much difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Somehow, Gordon and Diane were able to follow him into this next space where the others did not. And I wonder if there's like some sort of emotional attachments that he has, or if maybe they're manifestations of him. So that's why they follow him. Diane being a part of him, and so is Gordon Cole. Gordon Cole being this father figure in a way. But
I think they were able to follow him because they're the only two people that he wanted to follow him. Everybody else wasn't privy to the information of what was going to be on the other side of that door, why he should go in there alone. The fact that he unlocked it with the key to room 315, even though you're in the boiler room and there was no deadbolt. If you look at the door, there's no deadbolt that would go in and out.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a key. That's it. There's just a keyhole. There's nothing to activate a lock, and he just opened it. So it's all symbolic, and only they are going to understand it.
And even at this point, his observing face is still present, up to the point where they arrive at the Great Northern Boiler Room. And now before that door, Cooper says, after placing the key in the lock, "Now listen, I'm going through this door. Do not follow either of you." And then you see when he opens the door, you could see a bit of that rose wallpaper right there, which is the same wallpaper that was on the stairway with the woodsman in the vortex. And as Cooper closes the door, he says, "I'll see you at the curtain call." So I put a little bit of hope in this that we might get more Twin Peaks, and this sounds so morbid, but maybe there'll be some more Twin Peaks released upon David Lynch's death.
I'm not holding out for more Twin Peaks. I don't know if that's going to happen.
I'm just wondering if they've already recorded it and they're just going to keep it
in
a vault.
Well, they might. It might be extra footage for the Blu-rays too, though. You got to remember, and there's a book coming out. Maybe they're setting up to where it's going to drive more people to buy the book, even though I think everybody who would have bought it anyway, you know, and it could be hidden footage, but you know, there's other avenues that we might actually get it. I'm hoping for the Blu-rays, but it's going to be an expensive set considering it'd probably be like 16 or 17 Blu-rays.
Not romantic in the love sense, but romantic notion that he's waiting until his death, his final curtain call, like you're saying, and then we get two more episodes that were recorded at this time that were never released, and then we get the answer that we're looking for.
That would be amazing.
Like, we just had to wait until he died, but it is kind of morbid too.
I know. Cooper meets with Mike, and Mike says, "Through the darkness of futures past, a magician longs to see one chance out between two worlds. Fire, walk with me."
That was sweet.
I'm glad they had him do it. Like a live take of it. I'm glad that it wasn't like an overdub of his voice from way back when, because certain parts of the cadence were different. It had a different feel to it, and it was cool for him to say it forward and have it be forward and not the backwards lodge speak. So you know you're traveling between the worlds.
So Mike leads Cooper to Philip Jeffries through the same pathway that Mr. C was brought to Philip Jeffries before, except we don't see that woman.
Yeah.
Maybe because she is a Tremond or a Chalfont, and she's already moved into the Balmer house.
Yeah, she had other work to go do.
Mm-hmm.
The bosomy woman had to go be somebody else.
So now before Philip, Cooper says, "Philip?" And Philip says, "Please be specific." And Cooper says, "February 23rd, 1989, and that is the day that Laura was killed." Philip says, "I'll find it for you. It's slippery in here." It's like, wait, so are you not the teapot? You're inside the teapot?
I almost feel like he's talking about his mental state when he says it's slippery in here. He's trying to search through a whole bunch of mental data to get to this one point in time, and he's like, it's slippery because you're trying to grasp at something that's probably constantly moving in the steam or
the numbers spice, whatever's in it.
It is spice, yeah.
Yeah, I just imagined him, you know, sloshing water around.
Folding time and all, you know.
He says it's being like really waterlogged. Okay. He says, "It's good to see you again, Cooper." Say hello to Gordon if you see him. He'll remember the unofficial version. So I guess he feels that he's official now.
Yeah, this is how he's going to be for forever. So the old Philip Jeffries was just a...
Well, I mean, what kind of mindset would he have to think like that? There must be... It must have to do with his place in evolution that
for
he
sure.
maybe disdains the human form.
That's what I got from it. That's a common theme that kind of runs through a lot of science fiction or speculative fiction, that where when people become, they transcend the human form, then they look back on it as just being so limiting, and it's almost disdainful, mm-hmm. you know, that flesh and blood and bone holding you back.
Another thing he says is, this is where you'll find Judy. So this is in relation to that date, February 23rd, 1989. So this means this is in relation to Laura.
Do you think that that's what that is, or do you think this is where you'll find Judy when he's talking about the gateway that he's about to let him go through to basically travel time?
It's a good because point,
too. Because you're opening up.
Well, that's where he's heading to, is February 23rd, 1989.
But I mean the concept of it, the concept of doing what he's doing, because Philip Jeffries is facilitating Cooper's like travel back in time. He's allowing him to do that. This isn't something that Cooper has at his disposal, like that he can just kind of, like he doesn't have a TARDIS or anything. You know, I mean, he has to do it through either through Jeffries alone or some being like him. So
that's like a price that he has to pay is to...
a warning, more like how I perceived it, as saying like, okay, well, this is Judy right here. This is that negativity when you mess with this stuff. And as we see, it does eventually have, if not a bad result, you can say an undesired result, like something he didn't want or anticipate. Going back and messing with time is an iffy prospect at best. So you can screw up way more than you can help. If you're not careful, if you're not prepared to be up against all of the powers that are going to array themselves against you, powers that we don't even know about, that we weren't told about, but something grabbed Laura away from him on the walk back to her home.
Yeah.
So there was obviously some other power that he was up against that he did not anticipate and was not ready to go up against and couldn't defend her from.
All right. So Philip also says, there may be someone. Did you ask me this? I don't know what you guys made of that.
That seemed weird to me, that he would just come out and be like, did you ask me this? Like, he obviously didn't, because you've heard everything that's been said up until that point.
Mm-hmm. I guess this confirms the whole, like, it's slippery in here has more to do with his mental state.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, he's confusing conversations with other people.
And he's an unreliable person to ask things.
Well, he could have a little telepathy, too. Maybe Coop was thinking that. You know, we don't know what Philip Jeffries' powers are. So he could have been like, did you ask me that? Or am I possibly reading your mind? Or he could be crazy. You know, I mean, I wouldn't trust Philip Jeffries. The man's living in a teapot, for fuck's sake.
Cooper is a strong sender. Mm-hmm. And maybe Mike is, too. So he's also maybe picking up what Mike's
right?
wondering
Mike
about.
Mike definitely could have been thinking, like, oh, this guy's crazy.
Well, if you watch Mike's face the whole time they're having this conversation, he's acting like Tammy Preston. He can't sit still. Mm-hmm. He's just making faces and kind of moving around and, you know, like he's dancing to this weird conversation in his head.
So maybe he's inhabiting Tammy Preston.
Yeah. That's hot. I don't get that.
Tammy Preston's his host's body.
Could be worse.
There may be someone. Did you ask me this? So that might have to do with the Carrie Page person in Odessa. Who knows? Lots to speculate on there. And so now he generates the owl cave symbol, which is also what we call the mother symbol. It reforms itself into the two diamonds on top of each other, which then morphs into the number 8, which is like the infinity symbol. And we see within this infinity symbol this black orb. I'm not sure if that's what that's supposed to represent, but that is kind of working its way around that symbol.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
And it's like it stops at a certain point. And that's when Philip Jeffries is like, okay, now you can go. Now you can go through. Like he had to manipulate it to get it to that point somehow, and then it unlocks.
Yeah.
And they're able to go through. So if that's the infinity symbol for infinity, this is the point in time where they can go through and Cooper can do what he feels he needs to do.
Doesn't that seem like it's like a trap? Like the idea you're going to be in this infinity loop?
Yeah.
I don't know. I suppose it depends on if it's a one shot kind of thing, like you're in and you're out, you know what I mean? If he's stuck there, then I guess, because who knows what was gonna happen after he took her home.
Yeah,
if he was able to be successful at that, You know, he takes her home and then what? But we see that after he loses her, he's able to go to the lodge and talk to Mike and then kind of, you know, go back out into Glastonbury Grove. So I guess, I don't know. That might be like a deal with the devil. Maybe you are trapped to some extent. Like you can never fully get back out into what your perceived version of reality is. Yeah. That's like the deal you make.
It's kind of like him turning the dials. Like if there was a machine and an actual man in front of you, you would see him like, okay, you know, 1989, like the DeLorean type controls. It was cool that a guy in a steamy teapot is pulling out the steam and kind of showing you, like, if you move it a little to the left, you're going to offshoot. So I got it just right for you. You know, it was genius.
Go through now.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, maybe it's Philip Jeffries' fault that Cooper ends up where he ends up because he's proven to be somewhat unreliable as far as mentioning how it's slippery in here and thinking people are asking him questions that he hasn't. So, you know, maybe he's not the best person to send you somewhere.
Unreliable.
Yeah, I mean, look at the two time travelers we had in the show, him and Major Briggs, and they didn't turn out so great. One has no body and one's trapped in a metal bell.
So it's afterlife. You're able to enact some things on the terrestrial world to some extent, but you know, you are limited as what you're able to do because there's so much distance and weird translation of power that happens between the realms. So, but you do have an afterlife of sorts.
Mm-hmm. Which would kind of explain with Diane. She's kind of like the third person, and she actually can do maybe recreate her body the way she needs it. I don't know. Because the other two have their own shapes and forms, and maybe because she is who she is, she can do that.
But looking like the lodge is really specific. So Philip says, Cooper, remember.
So what do you think he's trying to get him to remember?
It's almost like he should be remembering some sort of warning.
Maybe what Laura told him in the lodge, what she whispered.
Yeah, maybe. Or this is where you'll find Judy. Maybe that's what he needs to remember.
Yeah, just another, like, back to the Judy reference, like, keep it in mind.
Mm-hmm. Which I don't think he does. So Mike says electricity. So he's helping to facilitate the power behind this transport, it seems. Cooper and Mike shift out. Cooper's eyes are closed. Now, we see the fan from the Palmer House, and this is footage from Fire Walk With Me. It's in like black and white, sort of. It's like a grayscale. Laura gets on James' bike, and this whole scene carries through as it does in the movie up into the point where we see Laura and James in the woods, and the thing that turns out the thing that frightened Laura that we've always wondered about was Cooper.
Right.
Hey, we wanted answers, so they gave us one.
Yeah. I mean, we can't complain when we get an answer, you know, even if it's not one that you're like, well, it makes sense, though. I mean, she's going to scream if she sees somebody watching them having this moment out in the middle of nowhere in the middle of the night. So,
I mean, she could have at least been, oh, there's a creep over there or something other than blood-curdling scream. But, you know, hey, it's the way Laura did things.
So Lauren and James, their scene continues to carry through until her jumping off the bike and running into the woods. We also see a quick scene of Leo, Rana, and Jacques waiting for her. Laura encounters Cooper, and she says, who are you? Do I know you? And he's just silent.
Creep.
Motionless. And she says, wait, I've seen you in a dream. In a dream. Cooper reaches out for her, but he does not move toward her. So I don't know if standing there godlike and in that way where you're, because only people in these like divine stories that are coming from the heavens are going to behave like that.
So you see this as another sign of his like arrogance almost?
I don't know about his arrogance. It's just.
Yeah. Well, it's a little less threatening. You know what I mean? If you have somebody that's like, please come with me, and they stand and wait, you know, it's a lot less threatening than him coming up to her and like walking up, especially in the state that she's in, trying to grab her. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? That's how I looked at it.
Body language.
Mm-hmm.
I could see that, but his stillness is a little threatening.
For sure. I mean, he could have said something.
But maybe this has happened before.
Yeah. Maybe there's an element, too, of for these things to work properly or for it to stick, he needs her to make the first move.
Yeah.
He needs her to, like, he's saying, here's the offer. Now I need you to initiate. You need to walk forward and touch my hand. And then, therefore, it's on you. You've done it.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't me grabbing you and going, come on, I'm going to take you to safety.
He could have stayed still and just said, come with me if you want to live. And everything would have facilitated a little faster. Just saying.
Come with me if you want to live.
Yeah.
She takes his hand. We see her body wrapped in plastic, and it ceases to exist. It's blotted out of existence. Now in color, Laura asks, where are we going? And Cooper says, we are going home. Josie puts on makeup, as we saw in Fire Walk With Me. Pete goes fishing, and nothing stops him from doing this act. So now at the Palmer household, we see Sarah Palmer. Actually, we hear Sarah Palmer before we see her. It's disturbing. It's her moaning. As Steve mentioned when we were watching it, it sounds a lot like Reagan from The Exorcist.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when everybody's downstairs before the exorcism takes place and she's making all these animal sounds, it sounds a lot like her. It was truly creepy. You know, like the hairs on the back of your neck go up because you're just like, oh, man. A woman supposedly alone in a house is just making all these crazy noises.
So what is this? What's happening here? Because she comes down, she comes into the living room, and she immediately makes a beeline towards Laura's photo, the famous photo. And she grabs a vodka bottle, an empty one, and starts bashing it in a like stabbing motion.
Yeah.
Breaks the glass. But it seems as if she's unable to mar the actual photograph because either this is the sort of time shifting that keeps preventing the act to continue, or if it's actually also supposed to show that it's repairing itself. Like she's unable to destroy.
Mm-hmm.
And so is this, if she is the mother, is this some sort of acknowledgement of defeat?
Well,
or is it something deeper?
For me, because when you're hearing her make these noises, I was looking around the house, and it was definitely the Palmer house during this last season, you know, because there's like this empty bottles, the cigarettes. So I took it as this is the mother figuring out that they're trying to change things, and she's about the time travel or whatever it is back to stop Coop. You know what I mean? Like, okay, I need to fix this, or sending a message back to herself, or however that's being works.
Yeah.
You know, however this being works, that by smashing it's the acknowledgement of this can't be completed. Cause then if Laura's mother was possessed at this time, why would he take it back to her house? So I like that it maybe taking its natural form or whatever back to swish her away, you know what I mean? Drag her away from Coop himself.
I had a weird idea about it and say, okay, you see Laura's body disappear, right?
Yeah.
And you see Pete get to go fishing, and you see, so you're assuming that there's this chain of reaction of events that doesn't happen because of Laura's death. Lots of stuff doesn't happen because of that.
Yeah.
So one of the things but you're not erasing history that came before that night in February in 1989. Yeah. So if this is a fast forward, Sarah Palmer might not be possessed by Mother at this point because this assumedly happened later on. It wasn't going on during the original series, at least as far as we know.
Mm-hmm.
So here you have the truth about what Leland was doing with Laura came to light. And here's this lonely old woman living in a house who doesn't have any contact with her daughter, who doesn't know where she lives. And her husband, you know, is not around because they got a divorce because of all the stuff that happened. Maybe he's in jail. Who knows?
Yeah.
And this is her current state, and she's just taking out her frustration and rage on the picture because she blames her daughter for what happened.
Yeah.
Just the off the wall.
No, I like it. I like it. Knowing what happened in 18 when she gets taken away, you think they take her into the real world, right? And it's just to stop Coop from getting a hold of her and finishing it.
Something breaks it. Mm-hmm. Something breaks his hold on her. And then she's still alive.
Yeah.
She doesn't die in the train car, but her existence is completely different at that point. That's
absolutely
all I really know. So
I also think Laura could symbolize for her failure as a mother. She's got a lot of guilt, and you know, we don't know anything about Sarah's past, but maybe she's had some sort of, you know, sexual trauma in her life, which I'm sure Leland, you know, had Bob within him since he was a child. So I can't imagine him being the greatest husband towards Sarah. So I think there's probably stuff that was going on there, and Sarah was probably too passive as a mother and allowed things to happen to Laura. And that guilt is probably what's really eating her up inside. And maybe everything we saw within her was actually symbolic of that. And so her stabbing that symbol is like her way of stabbing herself, or that part of her, that hate that she has.
Cool.
I like that better. I like that better than mine. That works.
Yeah.
Well, this is why we're also the dreamer, along with characters in this show, because we bring something to the table. And it doesn't mean that I'm more correct or Paul's more correct or you're more correct, that's Steve.
It's just
and that's why I like when people kind of get combative about theories. It's a little, I don't know, weird. It's just a friendly talk.
Yeah. If it was fact, it would be fact and not theory, right?
Yeah.
There would be something that would point to it being a fact, and we could recognize that.
Exactly.
And then lacking that, like this show, we...
I think this stuff is meant to make us think, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely.
So now we're to the final scene of this episode, and like Orpheus, Cooper fails to bring Laura out from the underworld. We hear... as he's holding her hand and walking, as he's escorting her through, the first clue that she's gone is that weird clicky noise that we were introduced to in the opening of part one. And then you have the whooshing noise and Laura's blood-curdling scream as she is whisked away. And the episode closes with Julie Cruise performing The World Spins.
And this is our last glimpse of the Roadhouse, probably forever. So, and it's fitting that Julie Cruise gets to play it because she was playing the first time we ever saw the Roadhouse.
So she got a place of honor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a person who hankers for the little bit more linear way that things could have ended with the Twin Peaks saga, go ahead and get to the point where Cooper is walking Laura through. And before you get to Sarah Palmer in her house, stop. Just press stop and be done. That was it. That was it. Fast forward to Julie Cruise singing at the Roadhouse and just be on your merry way. You will be a lot happier of a person for it.
Yes.
Or if you want a larger story told to you, go ahead and continue watching part 18.
All right. So that's our coverage for part 17 of The Return. We'll be back with part 18.
So, and part 18 will detail at the beginning of that podcast our plans for the feedback section.
Yes.
All right. So join us. This has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
All right. Now take my hand. Let's go.